491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFDRadio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 312, recorded on June 14th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line, as always, from Idaho is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line from Washington, D.C. is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Bill. Hi, Rachel.
Last week on the show, we talked about police budgets in municipal government and the issue of militarization of police. One thing that we didn't get to and which deserves its own episode is the issue of policing in schools and stuff like school resource officers and so on. Rachel, you looked up the history of sort of the origins of police in schools, which goes back, I think, longer than a lot of people would expect. And then we're going to be talking with Kelly about the current state of policy around the country on the issue of police in schools. So, Rachel, what is the historical origins of policing in American schools?
So it first started out like the student resource officer that we are kind of familiar with, was meant to foster positive interactions with the community because there was a lot of distrust during the Jim Crow era. So it was kind of seen as a way to foster these positive interactions and get more involved in the community. And from a few different sources, it looks like the first officer in a school in the United States was in Flint, Michigan in the late 1950s. It's not exactly sure what year that occurred. So they estimate that late 1950s. And I think there's some kind of confusion around the terminology. So student resource officers are licensed peace officers employed by either the county or local law enforcement agency, and they're assigned permanently to serve the school district or campus. When at school, they're treated as school staff and are under the supervision of the school's principal. When they're not at the school, they're supervised by the law enforcement agency that employs them. Another term is school-based law enforcement. And although they're used interchangeably, there are some differences. So the SBLE officers are employed by the school district through a school-based law enforcement department rather than a law enforcement agency. So they're actually employed by the school district in which they work. In the beginning, there weren't a lot of schools that actually had school resource officers. I believe in the 1970s, only about 1% of schools had school resource officers. However, with the beginning of the war on drugs during the Nixon administration, schools were seen as a site for drug use and the violence that was associated with drug use. So young police officers were sent into schools posing as high school students. I'm sure we've all heard of 21 Jump Street, both the 80s TV show and then the recent movies that came out. So these recruits were sent to find and arrest students with drugs, most often with minimal amounts of marijuana. In Los Angeles, 176 students were arrested from just six high schools as part of a tactical raid, and the overwhelming majority was just for marijuana possession. These tactics were not an essential function of public safety, but rather a means to survey, catalog, monitor, and control youth of color. And this comes from the ACLU reports called Bullies in Blue. And it's about the history and current conditions of school policing. the use of school resource officers and other law enforcement officers in schools actually increased dramatically in the 80s due to this war on drugs, and also because there was a perception that there was a serious rise in juvenile crime. A survey in the 1980s revealed that over 87% of adults believed that there was this basically juvenile crime wave. Violent crimes actually went down, and schools were never the epicenter of violence. Any youth violence or youth crime actually happened outside of schools. But there was definitely this focus on putting law enforcement officers in schools to I guess, monitor and track students, especially students of color. There was a perception that a lot of these youths were pre-delinquents, and a lot of focus was put on, almost a minority report. They were, trying to prevent crime and predict crime before it even happened just by really cracking down on student behavior that was relatively minor. So tagging or skipping school or throwing spitballs became increasingly criminalized behavior. This continued into the 90s, especially with the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, which kind of saw the rise of the rhetoric of super predators that kind of came out during that time. So this fear of juvenile crime just kind of increased, even though youth violence was actually declining by the mid-1990s. There were definite calls for increased policing of schools. And the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act actually allocated $9 billion to increase the numbers of police officers on the streets and encourage crime prevention through community policing. And the Federal Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, or COPS, was formed to administer the funds. And a lot of these grantees placed emphasis on youth policing. And among the early grantees, the expanded Los Angeles Unified School District Police Department, so a dedicated school police department, received funding in 1996 for more than 29 additional police officers. So there was this obvious disconnect between the perception of youth crime and the actual numbers of youth crime. So some numbers here. According to the National Center for Education Statistics Indicators of School Crime and Safety, the percentage of students aged 12 to 18 reporting the presence of security guards and or police officers in their school increased from 54% in 1999 to 70% in 2003. And a lot of that also occurred because of the Columbine shootings in 1999, which shifted the focus from drugs more to school shootings. I just want to point out that school shootings happened in relatively affluent schools. I believe Columbine was a fairly affluent white school. And however, a lot of these school resource officers were put into schools with high percentages of people who had to have free school lunches, inner city schools, schools that were majority non-white. So there, even though the actual crime was happening in schools where the students were affluent, a lot of the policing actually occurred where there were a lot of non-white students, a lot of people living in poverty, a lot of people on welfare programs. So there was definitely a big disconnect between the actual crime and the perceived crime. I did want to mention the COPS office, the Community-Oriented Policing Services, created the COPS and Schools Grant Program, which awarded over $750 million for the hiring of more than 6,500 SROs. This occurred in 1999, was started in 1999. And the grants were only good for 3 years, so they provided the funding for school resource officers for those 3 years, but after that, the schools had to figure out their own alternative funding. And often that came at the expense of funds that could definitely go for other things in schools, such as nurses, counselors, aides, and so on.
I think we're going to be talking about that with Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
the history of the police in schools certainly goes back further than I think a lot of people might think, because the focus has been so heavily on the school shootings issue for so long. And before that was, as you said, about the, you know, kind of metal detectors and cops in schools in the 80s and 90s to, you know, do precog against these juvenile delinquents who were going to turn into mass murderers or whatever, and drug dealers, allegedly. There's obviously also, you know, it would be a little bit farther afield than what we're talking about, but, you know, before the 1950s, well, and continuing into that period, obviously, but, you know, in the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, the sort of biggest police-like function in associated with schools popularly was probably the truant officer, you know, who would just kind of be going around trying to find kids playing hooky, you know, go check out the parks or whatever, that kind of thing, or go to somebody's house, be like, hey, why aren't you in school, and drag you there. This was sometimes referred to as a talent scout for reform schools, which is a funny way of looking at it, I guess. And that's sort of the precursor to what we would today refer to as the school to prison pipeline, which, of course, I think a lot of people would agree, really functions pretty smoothly compared to not having an officer on duty in the school. So Kelly, Rachel just alluded to the fact that a lot of these school resource officers or other campus police, especially at the high school level, were initially paid for federally with grants, but then communities had to struggle to find the money to cover those costs, which often meant sacrificing other things. So you were going to walk us through some of the current statistics today about our, you know, police in schools now, but also specifically what resources school districts have given up in order to make that possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what really strikes me about what Rachel just shared with us about how these school resource officers and cops came to be in schools is that it was not the case that individual schools were saying, hey, you know what we need? It's a police officer. It was largely a federally funded strategy through the Cops and Communities Grant, as well as the Safe and Drug-Free School Act, that sort of got school districts hooked on having cops in their schools. And then the funding dried up, and now school districts were forced to pay, well, not forced, but decided to pay with for school resource officers out of local funds. And while we've been, while I've been reading about this and thinking about this, I've been thinking a lot about the fact that nobody wants to be the mayor that takes cops out of schools and then something bad happens and kids get hurt. So mayors and school districts and leaders across the country and communities decided that cops were not going to be the things to get cut from a budget, but rather they would go without school nurses or librarians or art teachers, that sort of thing. So I started by trying to figure out, thanks to the background Rachel just gave us, why are there police in schools? And obviously, there's a long history of that. And more recently, there is also a history of laws being enacted at the state level that actually require police officers to be in schools, particularly in high schools. That takes away the option of eliminating this from a budget or of a school deciding that they want to take a different approach to school discipline, school safety. Notably in Massachusetts, every chief of police has to assign a school resource officer to each school district. Kentucky recently signed a law requiring all Kentucky schools to have an armed officer. And when Governor Beshear was asked about that, he essentially just said, like, I don't want to be the guy in charge when something bad happens at a school and there's nobody there to protect kids. So that was his thinking, despite the fact that, as Rachel pointed out, schools have become increasingly safe places, which is not in line with the increase in police that we see there. Also, I was surprised to learn that some school districts actually have their own police departments. And while it's hard to get numbers on exactly how common that is, of the 25 biggest school districts in the U.S., at least 10 run their own police force. In Texas alone, 200 school districts run their own police force. And notably in Houston, where George Floyd graduated from high school, their school district has a police force with a budget of about $10 million and 200 officers. So it is not the case that this is some small line item, but schools are choosing not only to contract out with the police, but in some cases to build their own police force within their school district. And I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I do think it's worth noting that very few states have standard training or even responsibilities for their school resource officers. Only 12 states even require any sort of student-specific preparation. I think this is the reason I don't want to spend a lot of time on this is because I think it's sort of secondary to the fact that police officers don't really belong in schools, regardless of what kind of training they have. It just to me reinforces the narrative that there is a high profile school violence event. People rush to say, oh, we're going to put police officers in schools, we're going to have armed guards in school, but there's really no follow through in either making sure that folks are prepared for that role or in evaluating whether that response is making kids any safer. And in fact, there actually is no evidence that it makes schools safer. There are a number of studies that have looked at this question: do police officers in school make students safer? And there's been really mixed results. A report from the Congressional Research Service noted that studies of school resource officer effectiveness that have measured actual safety outcomes have mixed results. Some show an improvement in safety and reduction in crime. Others show no change. Typically, studies that report positive results from school resource officer programs rely on participants' perceptions of the effectiveness of the program rather than on objective evidence. Other studies fail to isolate incidents of crime and violence, so it is impossible to know whether the positive results stem from the presence of school resource officers or are the result of other factors. So school districts across the country are making really huge investments to keep students safe, except there's no proof that it actually keeps students safe. So this feels like it just like a really important note for everyone to be thinking about, especially in a time of budget cuts at the municipal level across the country. I think something that I've thought about a lot about in having police officers in schools is you can sort of imagine in a high school where two kids get in a scuffle, they punch each other. It's not good. It shouldn't happen, but it does happen in schools from time to time. There's some sort of adolescent fight going on, and the history teacher walks by and is able to break it up, and the history teacher brings folks to the principal's office and folks are suspended. And suspension has its own issues. We could talk about that separately.
I think we'll get back to that later. Yeah.
But that is different than a police officer walking by, seeing two adolescents punching each other. And the police officer has been trained that what he is witnessing is an assault. And now this schoolyard fight goes from being something that gets you suspended to a week to something that gets you a criminal record, could have you showing up in court and all of the fees and costs and issues associated with that. So you can imagine how that would play out in a schoolyard. And there's also a lot of research that suggests this is actually how it is playing out. And I think one of the statistics that sort of hit that home for me was from the Justice Policy Institute, who found that even when controlling for school poverty, schools with a school resource officer had nearly five times the rate of arrest for disorderly conduct as schools without a school resource officer. And disorderly conduct can essentially be anything. It means it didn't fall into any other of the categories of any sort of violent crime or drugs or having a weapon. It means adolescent was disorderly because that's how adolescents are. And if there is a school resource officer in your school, that's sort of regular, imperfect, but regular adolescent behavior is more likely to get you arrested rather than, you know, sent home for the day or sent to suspension or any of the other disciplinary routes that schools may take. And of course, having a school, now that most of these police officers are funded at the local level, it means that money is being spent for police instead of other other folks who are perhaps more well-equipped to help students. ACLU pointed out that 1.7 million students are in schools with police but no counselors. And over 10 million students are in schools with police but no social workers. So it is not the case that our schools are have endless resources. Schools each year have to make really difficult decisions about what to fund and what to not fund. And schools across the country, time and time again, have decided to fund police officer positions rather than social worker positions. Some of those are local choices, and some of those choices are the result of state laws that require require some sort of law enforcement in the schools. And ironically, but not in a funny way, there is no evidence that school resource officers make students safer, but there is a lot of evidence that shows that school-based mental health providers not only make students more successful in school and improve student health, but also can make the whole school safer. So this intervention of having school-based mental health resources that has been shown to be effective is being defunded for the sake of funding police, which has not been shown to be effective. So there's a head scratcher for you. And I don't think it will surprise anyone to know, but I do absolutely think it's worth saying, that the effect of having school resource officers in school, it disproportionately hurts students of color and students with disabilities, who are the most likely to be suspended in a typical school context without the police involvement, but are also more likely to be arrested or involved with the police if there's a school resource officer in their school. And not only does it affect students in the way that it affects students in the sense that they could end up with a criminal record or that sort of thing, but it also really changes the tone and tenor of the school. There's a study in Texas that actually found that the graduation rates and college enrollment rates of Black boys significantly decreased if there were police in the school. And there was a story I was reading about the school resource officer giving tickets on the first day of school for kids who rode their bikes to school without a helmet, because in that particular state, you could get a ticket for not wearing a bike helmet. I am all for wearing bike helmets. Everybody should do it. It's very cool to wear a bike helmet. But you have to think about how a student now feels. They've shown up after the summer. Their first interaction with an adult at a school is a police officer giving them a $57 ticket for not wearing a bike helmet. That's not going to make them particularly excited to go to school the second day. And you can sort of imagine that on an even larger scale. If your friend got in, a schoolyard fight and ended up with handcuffs around his wrists and a criminal record, this isn't the way to create an inviting learning environment. And I think that's something that a lot of people have been forced to think about in the past few weeks, is that police don't make everyone feel safe. I'm a white woman. I remember in college, you know, you walk home at night and you like run from blue light to blue light on college campus because there's some sort of like safe feeling that comes from knowing you can call the police. But that feeling doesn't exist for everyone. And so to put police officers with weapons in schools makes a lot of our students feel less safe. And how are you supposed to concentrate on algebra if there's a man you don't trust, you know, roaming the hallways with a gun? So I think that there is sort of an undefined, very difficult to measure effect that these that police officers in schools have that can really alienate schools from the community, despite all the research that shows that the more and more school can become a part of a community, the more successful students and families can be. And so all of this rather depressing and dismal news about police officers in schools and the effects that it's having on our students really left me thinking about where we go from here. And of course, right off the bat, there is the need to address laws that require school resource officers in schools and require communities to spend their school money, their education money in this way. I think that would be a very obvious first step. But there are also real questions about how to truly invest in social emotional health and support for students, rather than just sort of paying lip service and saying it's something that you're committed to at press conferences. There's some energy in some communities around peace builders, which could be trained in conflict mediation rather than having police officers in schools. There's a lot of excitement in some of the research that's being done around restorative justice in schools. But the truth is that this is largely a total reimagining of school safety. And it's going to take significant effort and resources to get it right. And a challenge with all of these programs is generally fidelity to the program, especially in something as intensive as restorative justice. It really requires all of the adults in the building to sort of be bought in and carve out time from the day into this for this sort of program. So it is not the case that there are solutions ready to sort of pull off the shelf and replace school resource officers with. But it is true that there is a lot of research that shows that investing in students' mental health and giving them opportunities for conflict resolution not only makes the school safety and safer in the short term, but also sets students up for more success in the long term. One really important thing that I want to say as well is that all of this conversation has really centered around school resource officers, which is a sort of like narrow sector of the way in which in very specific position in a school. But I think that school discipline more generally and the sort of environment that we have created in schools is going to take a much bigger solution than just removing school resource officers. If you think about the message that it sends that students have to go through metal detectors to get into a classroom, if you think about the security guards, many of whom are armed and are actually separate from this school resource officer position. And security guards in many ways have sort of less training, less clear responsibilities, and maybe even less oversight and accountability. But in these conversations that are so specific to school resource officers, many folks are sort of forgetting about these security guards. And Minneapolis, which was one of the first to cut off their contract with the police department, has said that their school safety plans will still include security staff who may or may not be armed. But it is not the case that simply removing this one position is going to fix the sort of militarized environment that we've built in many of our schools.
I think that's a good transition, Kelly, because what I wanted to drill down on a little bit more was the concept of zero tolerance policies and almost a broken windows theory of schooling, which I think parallels very closely what was happening outside of the school walls. Because as you say, you know, just focusing on the school resource officers alone doesn't really contextualize that within the broader history. And even the history that Rachel was talking about doesn't make a whole lot of sense unless you're looking at it also within the context of what was going on outside with, you know, tough on crime politics in general, right? There was an article which is a co-article between Vox and the Justice Policy Institute about the school-to-prison pipeline, which had a few specific points about this. One thing that Rachel, I believe, already mentioned was the Gun-Free Schools Act in 1994, right? This is passed just a couple years after the peak of the crime wave in general, not in schools specifically, but it's also, interestingly, before Columbine. That is probably, you know, if you had to guess when they were writing it, I'm guessing they were thinking about urban schools and handguns more than they were thinking about, you know, suburban school shooters. One of the things that that included was, it's two important things. First of all, mandatory year-long out-of-school suspension for any student. And secondarily, not just for guns, even though that was what the title was, but any weapon. This is something that was being rapidly adopted all over the country as a general policy, obviously also for drugs. That's another one that's common. But weapon was defined quite broadly. They give some examples here. Students making finger guns, you know, just pew-pew with their fingers. That could be considered a weapon or threat or whatever, they're threatening a school shooting. Chewing a Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun, bringing a camping fork from Cub Scouts to class. All of these things could be interpreted, and had been, as a weapon and therefore cause for a year of out-of-school suspension. In general, as Kelly said, suspension can be a huge problem. Even if it's not a year, just messing up someone's routine that much, potentially, you know, they may have food insecurity issues that they're not getting fed while they're out of school as much as they would be if they were in school. Potentially, it's creating chaos at home because their family situation doesn't really allow for someone to be home babysitting them. Potentially, they end up getting up to shenanigans outside of school while they're on lengthy out of school suspension, you know, several days, 2 weeks, or even up to a year, potentially. As Kelly said, that often leads to various other problems, dropout issues, things like that, people just not finishing high school. But a lot of this stems from, again, an overall sort of approach that we had seen first adopted outside of schools for the crime, you know, solving crime in general in the United States, which we now know did not work, or at least that's not really why the crime rate went down, contrary to what some people are still trying to tell you. But it is essentially a broken windows theory of policing, except in schools. So as the article notes, the broken windows theory emphasizes the importance of cracking down on small offenses, in like broken windows, for example, in order to make residents feel safer and discourage more serious crimes. In schools, it translated into more suspensions for offenses that previously hadn't warranted them, talking back to teachers, skipping classes, otherwise being disobedient or disruptive, which, as both Rachel and Kelly alluded to, that's kind of just like you're taking normal adolescent behavior and stuff that's like a little bit outside of, you know, I mean, it's not great, right? Like, nobody's saying, oh, this is awesome that they're doing like petty vandalism or whatever. But like, I mean, maybe some people are, but like, it's not really a huge problem in the grand scheme of things, but treating it like you're a precog in Minority Report and that the next thing they do is going to escalate to murder or something like that. So that's like a huge problem. And the approach of, as Kelly said, taking a like, you know, normal fight or something and escalating it to like, oh, we've got to arrest these people for assault. That obviously has huge knock-on implications as well. And as Kelly said, the racial implications are particularly stark in that various discipline in general, even if it's in-school discipline and not criminal discipline, has, you know, disparately enforced on, you know, for especially Black students, also Latino students. The actual, like, you know, arrests, sending people to juvie, things like that, tends to be certainly disproportionate. And in general, you're just escalating normal day-to-day school situations. And, you know, I think like people maybe in their head think, and sometimes I've heard people defend it like, oh, well, these, you know, this is why bullying is like less common in the hallways and stuff these days. You know, like people in school like are bullying less. It's like, well, okay, did it occur to you it might have just moved online? Like, I think there probably has been a decrease in bullying. But again, I think we can think of maybe more cultural factors and or as Kelly said, the overall like having a mindset in your school about how things should be done and having long-term follow through of like, you know, hey, you gotta like everyone in the school, all the adults in the school have to be like looking out for certain things that are going wrong and trying to intervene early and de-escalate situations, and, you know, stop bullying incidents from happening. All that's probably more productive than having a cop handle it. And all of these things sort of compound together. And as they said in this article, even when schools aren't deliberately sending someone to juvenile detention over something that happens in school, even just disciplining them in particularly strict terms, even a short suspension, is likely to start putting them on that pathway that eventually gets them into either juvenile detention or, after they turn whatever the local age is, the adult prison system for something. I don't know if this was the same study that one of you mentioned earlier, but there was a Texas study that said that students disciplined in middle school or high school, 23% of them ended up in contact with a juvenile probation officer compared to 2% who had never been disciplined in school. So even when you're not actually arresting them, just having like pretty draconian discipline in school can also lead to problems. And again, that goes back to that issue of zero tolerance policies and a broken windows approach to education and so forth. Obviously, as the article also notes, there has been a push more recently to try to counter these trends, but I think you really can't understand kind of the implications of all this without contextualizing it within the broader world of like tough on crime politics, which goes back to that point, as both of you have said, that like people don't want to be the mayor or the governor who said, you know, I'm removing police from schools, even though there's not a whole lot of evidence that, like, you know, you're going to stop a school shooting by having a police officer on campus, that sort of thing. Reactions, thoughts on any of this?
Something else I wanted to point out is the use of restraints in schools. So in the ACLU report that I would encourage everybody to look at, there's a lot of information there. They did a study of students in New York City non-arrest handcuffing incidents in spring of 2016. Students that were handcuffed in incidents that led to no police action, 100% of them were Black and Latino. And students handcuffed during a mental health crisis, Black and Latino students were 98%, and white or other were 2%. And also, these restraints are being used on increasingly young students. In 2014, they had to use special Velcro handcuffs on a 5-year-old Black student. This child had ADHD, and he had a tantrum when it was time to leave gym class. And then in response, NYPD officers placed him in restraints. Cell phone video captured him crying out for his mother, who said that the experience left Derek afraid to return to school. Using handcuff restraints as a de-escalation technique, particularly for a child experiencing a mental health crisis, runs counter to the federal guidelines on school policing and can initiate multiple forms of trauma that last long beyond the time they remain cuffed. So kind of piggybacking on all those statistics about the lack of trust or the lack of feeling safe in schools, these use of restraints also exacerbates that issue. And there's no reason to restrain a 5-year-old with handcuffs.
We know separately from this that like things like ADHD or autism spectrum disorders and things like that, any number of mental health issues tend to be dramatically underdiagnosed in young children who are not white, compared to, you know, the rate of diagnoses for their white peers who have the same things. And so what you're basically doing most of the time when, if you're trying to put restraints on a child that's having a tantrum, a minority child that's having a tantrum, is mostly you just are de facto arresting or in school arresting a small child that has ADHD or autism or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would just add, in thinking about the solution, the potential solutions to these issues, that as students eventually return to school, schools are going about to have an unprecedented challenge with students being out of school for so long and many of our students experiencing trauma while they're out of school, whether it be the trauma of not knowing where your next meal is, or there's a violent situation in your household or your neighborhood. A lot of students are going to be have been unplugged from school for quite a while now, and thinking about how to set up schools and prepare schools to welcome them back with open arms and make sure that schools are prepared to meet not only their education needs, but also their health and safety and mental well-being needs, social emotional needs. That is going to be a huge challenge when students do return to schools. And the longer students are out of school, the bigger that challenge is going to be. But I would just say that the over-suspension of students, the over-reliance on police in schools, the over-identification of students of color with disabilities, all of that is egregious in a regular time. I don't think we're prepared for what you're about to see as students return to school with a plethora of additional issues. So I am concerned that our schools are not ready for that.
Did you read more about those restorative justice? Because I remember reading an article about like the use of meditation or like yoga in schools. Was that in any of those articles that you read?
Yeah, the challenge is that there's on small scales, there is evidence that it's useful. All these programs are just so hard to implement with fidelity and largely rely on like one administrator with like a big personality to implement them. And it's just really hard to scale. Mm. It just the challenge of sort of the lack of an existing alternative to plug into this situation and the existing challenges around like the perception of school safety, whether even though the data doesn't show that the perception is real, makes me nervous that the school resource officers are just going to be replaced by like contracted armed security guards, and that we will have made like no progress towards the goal of creating a more, you know, healthy, holistic school environment.
Yeah, that's something I didn't realize that existed, these private security forces, because when I went to school, we did have a student resource officer, but he was relegated mostly to just like, I don't know, like high-fiving kids in the hall during like passing periods and stuff like that. He never really existed as I saw. I'm sure other students saw it way differently, but he didn't really, he wasn't a part of that violent discipline in my school. So I think it's obviously something that is colored by my experience as a white student, but my school was pretty, it wasn't a majority minority, but it was approaching 50% Latino. So I'm wondering if the Latino students definitely saw more of that disciplinary threat than I saw. And to kind of go back to that zero tolerance policy, I did grow up in a rural town that had a lot of hunters and fishers, and something that kind of goes with that broad definition of weapon is the fact that kids did have like hunting knives or like a Leatherman or whatever that if it was found in your car or in your locker, you definitely were subject to that really disproportionate expulsion or year-long suspension. So that's something that I wanted to point out. And also the ACLU report did point that out. A student, I believe, in Alaska, they conducted a no warrant search of his car, and they did find a fishing knife because his dad was a professional commercial fisherman. And so he was subject to that punishment as well. So it's definitely something that cuts across all demographics, this over punishment and over policing of schools. It happens everywhere from the inner city to the most rural districts. And I think that's something that these blanket policies that get adopted everywhere just doesn't really take into account the nuances or the demographics that exist in different towns.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's so significant that so much of this initiative started at the federal level, because what each community and each school needs really is so individual, and yet, you know, the federal government had the great idea to give grants for police officers. Schools got those police officers and sort of became hooked on them and are now having a very hard time getting rid of them, despite the fact that they're using local funds for it now, and it's coming at the expense of other school resources.
Right. Well, and I mean, I didn't look up to see what the vote was or which, you know, states were representatives and senators were in favor or against, but like, I'm certain that when they passed the federal legislation for zero tolerance, for example, for weapons, they had to be thinking of urban districts, right? That had to be what they had in mind. They must not have been thinking like, oh, this is going to affect people in Texas or Idaho or whatever who, you know, have knives or guns for hunting purposes and stuff like that in the truck. And I want to be absolutely clear here. I am not saying that like there is some sort of special distinction between these districts or whatever necessarily. I'm just saying that it didn't probably even occur to them, right? Because they didn't have that in mind. They probably thought like, oh yeah, we're taking on the urban youth crime menace or whatever, which I think is reprehensible to begin with, obviously.
And I think it goes back to what you said earlier about not wanting to appear like soft on crime or whatever. Growing up in the 90s, that was like the big obsession. The law and order politician who was determined to stomp out crime or whatever. It was the kiss of death if you appeared in any way to oppose more police or more interventions in the community or more anti-drug laws and stuff. So I think that definitely played a huge part in it, just that not wanting to appear soft on crime because you would guarantee it was guaranteed that you would lose your next election.
So I think that's a challenge with a lot of criminal justice reforms. You know, if you like commute sentences in one person out of a million goes on to commit another crime, that is going to play, your opponent is going to play that ad for 100% sure the next time you're up for election. And I think that I just am afraid that the American people don't have enough patience for really sifting through the data and figuring out what the story is when there are so many sensational stories that get your attention right away. I wanted to point out, while there seems to be a lack of like perfect solutions here, I did want to point out one story from Alabama. A judge in Alabama, Brian Huff, noticed that 80% of referrals to his juvenile court were from schools, which is insane. It means this court was pretty much just existing to like adjudicate school discipline issues. So he went ahead and established the Birmingham City Schools Collaborative. And what this collaborative did sounds fairly straightforward, but was sort of revolutionary considering all these referrals were going right to the courts. And they just developed a protocol for addressing these sort of normal but imperfect adolescent behaviors in school. And first, a student got a warning. Then a student would have to attend a school offense workshop with his parent. And then eventually a student may be referred to the juvenile justice system. But adding in those two steps, it seemed fairly obvious of the warning and some sort of intervention with the parent to try to adjust the behavior. Without those in place, everything was just becoming a referral to the juvenile justice system. So I think that as school, there are some good programs out there. Not a lot of them have been scaled to the sort of degree that we would need on a national level. But there are folks out there that have been looking at this question for a really long time and can start providing us information on at least, you know, how to start addressing this.
All right, so I looked up about the federal votes. There were two different things that were called gun-free schools. There's Gun-Free School Zones Act of 1990 and the Gun-Free Schools Act of 1994, tackling slightly different aspects of firearms possessions. I think the first one was mostly about, like, adults accidentally carrying them into schools, or I guess knowingly carrying them into school zones. And it's interesting, the 1994 one, because I was speculating earlier that probably it was being pushed with relation to more urban areas of the country. Overwhelmingly, Democrats voted in favor of the one in 1994, and Republicans from rural states voted against it. So they obviously knew what the consequences of that were going to be for their own constituencies, and in general don't like gun control particularly. But also, if you go back to the one in 1990, it is very easy to see it contextually within the broader tough on crime push. So this was, unlike the other one, which was under the Clinton administration, this one was under the George H.W. Bush administration. It's interesting that we see there's the 1990 thing and the 1994 thing, showing the continuity in ideology between the Republican administrations and Clinton administration. But you can see very clearly the 1991, how it fits into the broader thing, because they have on the Wikipedia page the list of other short titles, because all of these things were generally sections of a larger bill that was being passed. So the other things that were also incorporated: Anabolic Steroids Control Act of 1990, Child Protection Restoration and Penalties Enhancement Act of 1990, Comprehensive Thrift and Bank Fraud Prosecution and Taxpayer Recovery Act of 1990, Criminal Victims Protection Act of 1990, Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act of 1990, Financial Institutions Anti-Fraud Enforcement Act of 1990, Mandatory Detention for Offenders Convicted of Serious Crimes Act, National Child Search Assistance Act, National Law Enforcement Cooperation Act, Victims of Child Abuse Act, Victims' Rights and Restitution Act. The broader title of all of this was just an act to control crime. So you really can't divorce the sort of trending policies of the criminalization of school behavior and stuff like that, and putting police in schools and zero tolerance and all that, without looking at it in the context of this broader push on crime in general in the United States.
Yeah, and wherever you put police, you're going to find crime, right? Like, if you put police all over Wall Street, you're going to find crime, you know, probably a lot of crime.
Well, Rachel and I did an episode specifically about the lack of sort of investigations of, financial crimes by Wall Street and that sort of thing, and why that is that they aren't pursuing those.
And so in many ways, by putting police officers in school, particularly in schools where there are people or students of color, that's where you're going to find the crime. And so the decision to put police officers in those schools is a decision to arrest more students, and particularly students of color.
Yeah, I just really want to encourage people to take a look at the history, and especially to read that ACLU report, Bullies in Blue. It's long, it's 95 pages, but I think it does a really good job of not just showing the statistics, but they also highlight certain individual stories. And it puts a human face on the costs of over-policing schools.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for being on the show this week.
Thanks, Bill.
And Kelly, thank you as well.
Thank you very much.